This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. A new Alzheimer's drug is the first approved treatment to attack the disease process. Other medicines address the symptoms of dementia, not what actually causes it. Yet the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's approval is contentious. Some Alzheimer's experts say we don't have enough proof that the drug works. What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. Are you coping with dementia, or do you know someone who is? Is this a promising treatment, do you think? What do you want to know about it? 800-642-1234. Our guest is Dr. Art Walasek. He is the Vice Chair for Education and Faculty Development at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me back.
Dr. Walasek, what makes this drug so different than the other treatments we have for Alzheimer's?
Well, thank you. And thank you very much for covering this really important topic. I think what's been so exciting about this week is the heightened interest it's brought to thinking about dementia and Alzheimer's disease. There are about 6 million people in the U.S. who suffer from Alzheimer's disease, around 130,000 here in Wisconsin, and of course, many millions more around the world. So this is a hugely important topic. Alzheimer's disease is under-recognized, under-treated. So I've been very appreciative of the increased interest in this. But the news this week about aducanumab is that it appears to be a different way of addressing Alzheimer's disease. As you mentioned in the intro, our other FDA-approved treatments really kind of treat more of the downstream consequences of Alzheimer's disease, whereas if aducanumab works, it works kind of earlier on. It targets some of the underlying biology of Alzheimer's disease, and so potentially an important next step for us in taking care of people with Alzheimer's disease.
So how does aducanumab work then? What's in this new drug?
Yeah, so it gets to our current understanding of what Alzheimer's disease is. And just first off, there's the idea of dementia. Dementia just means some combination of losing memory plus changes in day-to-day function. And then there's, well, what causes the dementia? And Alzheimer's disease is the most common cause of dementia. There are other causes, but Alzheimer's is the most prominent one. And then kind of what causes Alzheimer's. So there are proteins in our brain called amyloid. We all have amyloid. And for reasons that really aren't completely clear to us yet, amyloid starts to clump together into these things called amyloid plaques. So that's thought to be part of the whole Alzheimer's process. There's another protein called tau, and tau gets all tangled up, and that creates the other part of the Alzheimer's process. So aducanumab is an antibody. We heard about antibodies in the news earlier with the COVID vaccine. So similar idea. This is an antibody that clears out amyloid. So the studies of aducanumab seem to show that the drug was actually able to clear some of this amyloid out of the brains of people who had Alzheimer's disease, which is an exciting development.
So we might be able to stop the body from having these plaques that destroy brain cells and really degrade the mind.
It's possible. I mean, that's sort of where some of the kind of the controversy comes in. We don't know for sure that doing that will actually have an impact in terms of people's memory, their day-to-day functioning, their behavior, the impact on caregivers. These are unknowns yet, and that's why the FDA in this approval on Monday said that the company that makes aducanumab has to do some additional studies because we do need to know more about what's the actual real-world impact of aducanumab. We don't know the answer to that yet.
Dr. Art Walasek is a geriatric psychiatrist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and we're talking about news now that there's a new drug that's FDA approved that can help work against Alzheimer's disease. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What's been your experience with Alzheimer's or other kinds of dementia? What do you think this new Alzheimer's drug could do? How do you think, if it does work, it could change your experience? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Walasek, what about the contention around this drug? What did the study show that made the FDA say this is promising and we should approve it?
Well, it's a great question, and there's been a lot of contradictory interpretations of the studies. So there was an advisory group last fall that advised the FDA to not approve aducanumab. I think the main issue is that again, it looks like aducanumab helps clear amyloid, so remove amyloid, but we're not really 100% sure about the clinical impact. I think there's also the issue of cost. So the company that makes aducanumab announced it's going to cost about $56,000 per year just for the drug alone. And there's more to it than just the drug. So the way you actually get this drug is it is infused into your veins every 4 weeks for about a year and a half. And so it's not just the drug. You got to go someplace to a clinical setting, and there are staff there and cost associated with that. There's a side effect of this drug called ARIA, A-R-I-A, which is kind of a form of brain swelling, which in most people, it seems like it ends up not being a significant problem, but it's something that's got to get monitored. And so people need an MRI of the brain, a brain scan before they start, and then a couple of times over the course of the year and a half they're on it. So that's another cost. And then we don't really know yet, like, well, who exactly is this for? So it's not everybody with dementia. It's probably just for the subset of people who have Alzheimer's disease causing their dementia. But we don't know, like, well, early, late, when exactly in the course. And how do we measure amyloid? How do we know that people actually have a lot of amyloid that can get cleared out? The way it was done in the drug study was another imaging scan, something called amyloid PET, and that's expensive, and Medicare doesn't pay for it. So there's concern about the cost, which could be pretty astronomical altogether, and about some of the side effects of aducanumab.
Alyssa from Sparta is a palliative care social worker. She wants to know, when might be the ideal time to prescribe the drug to someone?
What a wonderful question. Thank you. Yeah, that's exactly the issue. So in the study, in the two studies that led to the FDA approval, they were looking at people who had a condition called MCI or mild cognitive impairment. That's kind of the step before dementia. And they were looking at people with mild dementia, so kind of early stages of dementia. But beyond that, we don't know. You know, if it's later than that, is it too late? Has too much damage already been done? If it's earlier than that, how do we detect? How do we find someone who's got high amyloid but doesn't have any symptoms yet? So these are some of the challenges with figuring out how to use aducanumab.
Alyssa, thank you so much for that question. As we talk about this new treatment for Alzheimer's that's been approved by the FDA, Dr. Walasek, you also mentioned the clinical experience and the results are not fully known. Did patients in the trial see improvement?
Yeah, so there was there were two studies that were included in this approval, and basically in one of the studies there didn't seem to be a change on the cognitive side, meaning things like memory and decision making and so on. And in the other study, there were some changes. There were some improvements compared to the group who did not get aducanumab. So again, kind of a mixed result, and so hard to really say for sure. And why? It is why we need more research. We need to study this drug more, but also just in general, we need to continue our research into treating Alzheimer's disease. I kind of think of this as this is the next chapter. By no means is aducanumab a cure for Alzheimer's disease, but it's a step forward. It's another chapter in our understanding of how this illness works and how we can best help it out. And so we need to do more. We need to do more research and figuring out what are other more effective treatments for Alzheimer's disease.
Dr. Art Walasek is talking with us. He's a geriatric psychiatrist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We're talking about the clash surrounding a new Alzheimer's infusion that promises to slow the progression of the disease, while some experts aren't convinced. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about this new treatment or other treatments for Alzheimer's and dementia? Do you care for someone who deals with this? Help us understand your situation at 800-642-1234. This conversation continues. I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to The Morning Show. It's got a price tag of about $56,000 a year for treatment. The new Alzheimer's drug is a once-a-month infusion. The medicine is supposed to slow the progression of dementia for people who have mild memory problems, but it's not without controversy, despite FDA approval. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. Our guest is Dr. Art Walasek of UW-Madison. He works in the Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, and we want to hear from you. You can call 800-642-1234. What do you think about this new Alzheimer's drug? What questions do you have about it? Or what story are you willing to share about your experience and how new treatments for Alzheimer's might have changed what you had to endure? You can call now at 800-642-1234 or send it via email at ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Walasek, we talked some about the cost. You mentioned that some of the testing isn't covered by Medicaid, which is government insurance for very low-income people. Considering that cost and how new this drug is, are insurance companies willing to pay for it?
Well, so that's a wonderful question that gets into the practicalities of how do you actually get aducanumab to people. We don't know. So the next step, I think, is going to be that Medicare, which complements Medicaid. Medicare is the federal program for people over 65 and for people with other disabilities. Medicare will have to decide, are they going to pay for this? Maybe they'll limit it to certain populations. We don't know. We're speculating at this point. And then insurers often kind of follow suit based on what Medicare says. So stay tuned. We'll know more in the coming months about is anyone going to be paying for this, or will this end up being an out-of-pocket expense?
If people come to you with questions about this, how do you respond to them? Because I just feel like anyone who has experienced someone they know with Alzheimer's and watching that decline might be really hopeful, really encouraged by this opportunity, and yet we don't know that much about it.
It's such a terrific point. And I would say Alzheimer's disease and dementia it's so much more than just amyloid and plaques and tangles and all the other stuff. These are people who are suffering. They're suffering from memory loss, from changes in behavior. Their family members are often suffering, you know, watching their loved one go through this. Communities are affected. So really, there are a lot of different approaches that we have. We can support people with dementia. We can support their family members. There are respite programs, adult day programs, caregiver support groups. You know, there are lots and lots of other ways that we can help people out with dementia, not to mention continued participation in research to find other treatments as well. So I would view this week's announcement as hope that there might be a different path forward, and also a recognition that we do have lots of different ways to support people with dementia as well. So I hope this will lead people who are having memory problems or seeing their family members having memory problems, go talk to their doctor, get it checked out, figure out what's going on. There could be lots of other causes of their memory loss, like the medications they're taking or other medical conditions. So go get it checked out.
Let's talk about FDA approval. Tim from Madison called and says, just because the FDA approves something doesn't mean it's good to use. Matt from Wausau also wrote in and said, I mean, watch TV. It's constant ads for medicines that you should ask your doctor about. Like everything else in the U.S. healthcare system, Matt says, follow the money, not the results. So, Dr. Walasek, are there reasons that we should not trust the FDA in this?
Well, the FDA is it's the agency that we trust with helping figure out if a medication is safe and effective or not. Aducanumab was approved under a special accelerated pathway that is meant to get drugs to people faster if it seems like it's promising. So without the full usual evidence that we typically have for approval, this is a bit of a different mechanism. It's been used, as I understand it, with some cancer drugs as well. So it's a balancing act. You know, you want to make sure that medications people are getting are safe and effective. And at the same time, we want to get promising treatments to people because they are suffering. So that's the tricky balancing act that the FDA has.
We're talking with Dr. Art Walasek, who's a geriatric psychiatrist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We're talking about the new drug approved by the FDA to help treat Alzheimer's disease and some controversy that surrounds it despite FDA approval. And Dr. Walasek, how significant is the development of this drug when it comes to Alzheimer's research? I mean, this is what you do.
Yeah. So, first of all, a huge thank you to the thousands, if not millions of people worldwide who have participated already in Alzheimer's disease research. My colleagues at the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center and the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute are very actively involved in research of all sorts to help people with Alzheimer's disease. And so we will certainly need more of that. I think one other issue that we're sort of very actively interested in is, Alzheimer's disease affects a very diverse population of people. And we know that that persons of color, that Black people, Latinx people, Native American people all have markedly higher rates of dementia and Alzheimer's disease. And so we have to be thinking quite a bit about how do we help communities of color as well, and the sort of the additional burden of dementia in those populations. And so that's another research focus on making sure that everyone with Alzheimer's disease is getting the care that they need.
Do you think that the announcement of this drug or the development of this drug could affect research on treating Alzheimer's or into new therapies?
That is such a great question. I mean, my hope would be that this would spur further interest and that more people will want to get engaged in research. The fear is, oh, well, hold on. There's a drug for Alzheimer's disease. I'm going to go do that instead of participating in research. So I hope it's not the latter. I hope that this will spur people on to say, hey, look, there is some hope here. There are some new ways of approaching this disease. Let's go do some more research. Let's try to figure out what are other approaches that might be helpful.
Instead of assuming that one drug is going to be a cure, remind us again what we need to do at any stage of our life to try to lessen our risk of dealing with Alzheimer's and dementia later on.
Thank you so much for asking. I mean, I think one way to think about Alzheimer's is it's a disease that really progresses over many years. And there are things that we can do earlier on in life that hopefully reduce some of that risk. And some of them are basic things that we recommend for most every condition, which is make sure to get good regular exercise, get that heart rate up on a regular basis. A healthy diet. So as best as we can tell, the closer you get to a Mediterranean style diet, the better for heart health, for brain health, and perhaps for reducing risk of dementia. Avoiding things like alcohol and other drugs, not using those to excess, since those can be a problem. Addressing other medical conditions. So things like high blood pressure and diabetes, depression, addressing all those things can be helpful. And I would add, in this time of a pandemic, something that's been really challenging is staying active, especially socially active and engaged. So those social networks can be really helpful in engaging our brains and keeping us stimulated and mentally active, and hopefully reducing our risk of developing dementia.
Dr. Walasek, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you so much for covering this really important topic. And I hope that folks who have memory loss or are concerned about a loved one with memory loss, go talk to their doctor about it.
Thank you for that. Dr. Art Walasek is Vice Chair for Education and Faculty Development at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And he helped us understand what we know and the questions that we still need to answer about a new drug approved to treat Alzheimer's disease. The FDA approved it, and yet some experts say research hasn't proven that it actually works. Up next is news and a story of our Wisconsin life. Then we have the superintendent of Green Bay Public Schools on to talk with us about the school year that was and what lies ahead. We're taking your calls, your experiences at 800-642-1234. You can also share what it was like for you by emailing ideas@WPR.org. That conversation is ahead. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. Ahead, we're talking to the superintendent of public schools in the Green Bay area. We're looking back at the year and ahead to summer school and what the fall could look like. Right now on the Ideas Network, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum on a program that hopes to promote healing through poetry and sharing stories. And you should know this story discusses sexual assault and human trafficking.
Human trafficking is a reality across Wisconsin. It impacts urban and rural communities. It involves young people and older ones, men and women. The legal difficulties that survivors of trafficking face can be substantial, and the trauma they've experienced can be immense. The new podcast, Human Powered, from our partners at Wisconsin Humanities, is exploring this issue in one of its episodes. Here's producer Jade Isery-Ramos.
There's a legal clinic in Wisconsin that works with survivors of human trafficking and sexual assault. It's called LOTUS.
The demand for our services is tragic, heartbreaking, constant, and growing.
That's Rachel Monica Wilcox, the founder of LOTUS. Her team provides legal support for their clients, but they also invest in survivors and really help them share their stories, if they choose to.
For me, it's really nurturing to be able to help forge a path for somebody who's coming up, because I have walked this walk. There's a reason I'm a trail runner. You know, it's my destiny to break a path. And then I feel strongly whenever I just sit down with somebody, start talking, and I say, oh, I know where you are. I've been there. Try and look at it this way. This is what happened for me, and maybe that will help you.
It started off as a pretty straightforward legal clinic, and Rachel was connecting with survivors, finding lawyers, chasing down grants. But all this work she was putting in didn't just help others. It also gave her a way to integrate her own healing with the work.
LOTUS is the answer to an unmet desire in my heart for how I could have been helped. I truly struggled with deep depression, with anxiety, with suicidal behavior throughout my teenage years. And a lot of that was just the result of early childhood trauma. I was sexually assaulted when I was 7. But no one really knew the real story, because you only start to manifest what's wrong with you, and then people start attacking your symptoms. But nobody ever really asked me, what happened to you?
Back at LOTUS, Rachel started making space to have conversations, to tell the untold stories. Actually, that became the name of the new project at LOTUS, Untold Stories. It's a writing and art-making workshop for survivors of trafficking and gender-based violence.
When you can bring those 15 people together in that room, and within an hour, everyone is crying and laughing and loving on each other, because you don't have to explain. There is a bond. It's undeniable.
Sitting in that room in that kind of a circle with people who've been through similar experiences and hearing them speak candidly, clearly, with empathy and with incredible creativity and imagination was very inspiring.
For the last 2 years, the Untold Stories Workshop has been led by Austin Reese, who first came to Untold Stories as a participant.
You have these negative feelings, these very hard, painful emotions and memories, but you take them and you transform them into a positive, into a small creation, if you will, a poem.
So the group reads poems, they talk about poems, and then they write their own and share them. Slowly, everyone finds their voice.
There's something implicit about poetry where it has an audience. It's meant to be spoken, it's meant to be heard, it's meant to move somebody in what I would call a brief, intense agreement of feeling. And these moments are rare in life, but I think the gift of a poem is that when you put it out there to be heard, there is this sense of genuine connection and empathy.
The writing workshop brings out different things in people. Where I see it ending at the end of the day is that it gives people a powerful tool for finding their own voice to identify themselves and get their feet firmly planted in the honesty of who they are. Know your truth. Know your truth. And then if they choose, speak your truth.
That story came to us from Human Powered, a new podcast from Love Wisconsin and Wisconsin Humanities. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
You're listening to The Morning Show. Thanks for being with us today. More than 800,000 kids took public school classes in Wisconsin this year, and their experiences were vastly different. As educators close up their physical classrooms and virtual students turn in those devices for distance learning, we're talking about what a year it's been and what happens next. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Do you work in education? What challenges did you face this year? Maybe you're a parent or you're a school kid. Tell us about your experience at 800-642-1234. Steve Murley is superintendent of the Green Bay Area Public School District, and he joins us now. Steve, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to start with you. You were hired as Green Bay's superintendent essentially at the start of the pandemic in Wisconsin. What are you thinking about as you close your first full school year?
Well, certainly it's a bit of an odd start. I had an in-person interview, and then everything went online after that. And I came here in July, and to be honest with you, I'm still meeting people face-to-face every day, and even though we're at the end of the school year. So it's been a challenging year for kids. It's been a challenging year for staff, families, and certainly for our community. But I think the one thing that has really come through is I've listened to our high school graduation speakers the last week here, is the grit, the resilience, the determination, the ability to persevere that I've heard from those graduating seniors as they talk about the experience they had this year. I think sometimes we focus a lot on the academic content that students get over the course of the year. And it's important to remember that they learn many, many other lessons as they proceed through their school years.
What have you learned about tackling big challenges then this year?
Well, I think one of the things that we've learned is that we can move a lot quicker than we used to think we could. I think that in the public sector in general, education is no different. We're very deliberate about the work that we do. Definitely a measure twice and cut once type of planning process, which tends to take time. And when faced with a crisis, I think one of the things that we prove to ourselves is that we can adapt and change quickly, and that after implementing change when things don't work, we can retool and come back with new solutions in fairly short order.
What's an example of one of those times when you had to pivot quickly and now you realize that that innovation will probably be here to stay, at least in some form?
I think one of those is, you know, globally, if you look at it on a large scale, obviously it's this online learning component, but it's how we use it and how kids interact. And I think one of the things that we saw was an ability of teachers and students to adjust to this new environment. So when we came back to school, when we brought our kids back, one of the things we heard loud and clear from students and parents was that they formed a bond with their teachers over that first 6 months of school, and they really didn't want to lose that when they came back to class, whether they were coming back, if you will, to the physical classroom or staying virtually. And so after lengthy debate about that and a plan that we had set up that would actually have moved online kids into one set of classrooms and physical kids into another, we pivoted and created a high-flex environment where students stayed with the same teacher. And if you walked into a classroom, you might find the teacher had 80% of their kids in person and 20% on site or online, or 95-5, 50-50, it depended classroom to classroom. And watching the students adjust to that, watching the teachers adjust to that was pretty impressive. So that's something that I think you're asking about, you know, what stays with us. I think that, that those are the kinds of lessons that we've learned as we look at what does online learning look like in the future, is how we manage that environment in such a way that students can get the greatest amount of impact out of that.
Well, you're also talking about those connections between teachers and their students, which makes me think of mental health and how you say we talk about the academics in the organization, but there's a real mental health piece to what's happened to kids and adults, but kids over the last year. What have you seen?
You know, I think one of the things with mental health is it's always been an invisible crisis for us in school. It would be manifested in the past in incidents of major crises that students experienced, and that would draw attention to it for a short period of time, and then it would become invisible again. And I think one of the things that the pandemic has done is it's made that mental health crisis in our youth visible all the time. If you look around the state of Wisconsin, you will find mental health deserts, just like you find food deserts, and that is places where parents are unable to get services for their children. They either have to drive extensive distances or they have incredibly long wait times for their children to be seen. And a mental health crisis isn't something that you can wait on. And I think it's really brought that to the fore. So in schools, we're looking at how we can set up that first line of support for students. And then we're working with our community partners to start talking about what does the long-term solution look like? Because for many of these children, they're going to need support beyond that first level of support that we can provide in schools. And how can we better partner with those community providers to make sure that students have access?
We're talking about how Wisconsin students and teachers, administrators, and support staff made it through this school year, and we're also looking ahead. Our guest is Green Bay Area Public School Superintendent Steve Murley. You can call now at 800-642-1234. What has your school learned over the past year about new ways to teach kids? What innovations do you want to see stick around? Maybe you're signing someone up for summer school. Tell us about it at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. This conversation continues here on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Parents and teachers are recognizing the academic and social effects of the pandemic. We are talking about the year that was and what is ahead for us when it comes to summer school for kids in Wisconsin, and then looking ahead toward the fall at what school will look like in our K-12 system. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. Our guest is Steve Murley. He's superintendent of the Green Bay Area Public School District, and you're part of this conversation at 800-642-1234. We've got Jackie from Appleton ready to join the conversation. Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning. Hi. So I'm an instructor at the college level, a teacher at the high school level, and a parent of four children in two different school districts. I have noticed over the last year with all the experiences that have culminated that I think we really truly need more mindfulness training in schools for both instructors and students. I have a lot of friends who do work with school psychology type things, and I guess I just feel like it's one of the missing pieces. I think that education is slowly starting to morph into something different, especially after this last year and all the things we've seen that we are capable of doing when times get tough. And I think it's a good time now to start analyzing what's truly important that we, you know, take the time to educate our students with. And I really think mindfulness training should be a piece of that.
Jackie, thank you so much for bringing that up. And Steve, you can hear Jackie has a lot of perspectives there. Where does mindfulness show up for your teachers or your students in the Green Bay area?
You know, I think that's a wonderful point, because I think we're seeing that not just in school, but I think we're seeing that in all of our lives. I think for many of us, we were going at 100 miles an hour. And I've got three boys. I just had the youngest one graduate from high school. Schedules packed, dawn to dusk. And there was a relentless pursuit of whatever fill in the blank goes after that. We had a chance to reset, and I think that she's absolutely right that that mindfulness component, we talk about metacognition, thinking about your thinking process, that really helps us to take better advantage of the education that we receive in the classroom. And so we've worked to create spaces in our classes, in our classrooms, where we can begin that work. I'll use the high school as an example. We introduced an advisory period at our high schools. It proved to be very popular with students and with staff, and we're going to continue that as we move into the next school year because it provides that opportunity to be connected to your colleagues, your peer students, and also to a faculty member in a way that is not connected to an education component. It's not a class. There's not homework. There's not that type of expectation. It allows different types of conversations to occur there. So I would agree 100% with the idea that we need to make sure that we've created space in the system for our children at all age levels to be able to think and process so that they can take better advantage of teaching and learning.
Democrats and Republicans in the Capitol want to increase spending for school mental health programs. How do you see using that funding?
So I think there's a couple of things that really can benefit our kids. I think, as I mentioned earlier, we're really that first line of support. If you spend any quality time with teachers, you know the extent to which they know their kids. And so if there's a challenge that a child is having, often the first person who's going to see that is the teacher in the classroom. When they know that they have resources available to them in the school that they can turn to for support for that child, it gives them an opportunity to provide immediate assistance. So we're looking for those resources that we can actually place in the schools. But then, as I said earlier, for many of our kids, they need some long-term support. That doesn't happen during the school day or at school. So we have to figure out how we can better partner with our community providers and make sure that they have enough adolescent mental health supports in their clinics and facilities so that they can meet the needs of our students. And really tightening that dialogue between school and community provider to make sure that there aren't gaps in the service for our kids.
We are talking about K-12 education with Steve Murley, who's superintendent of the Green Bay Area Public School District, and you're listening here on the Ideas Network. Steve, more students are enrolling in summer school this year. In fact, the State Department of Public Instruction encourages kindergarten through eighth graders especially to be part of summer learning programs. How are you adjusting your normal operations to accommodate a summer school increase?
First of all, the numbers are amazing. We have over 6,000 children enrolled already in summer school, and enrollment continues all the way through next Monday. We literally have kids enrolling every hour of every day, and we're adding staff and space on a daily basis to accommodate them. I think part of the solution for us as we look long-term for getting our kids back on track is providing a more robust summer school environment. So we've got a three-part component in Green Bay. We've got an academic piece that allows for remediation and enrichment. And then we have enrichment opportunities that are non-academic in the afternoon, so that we're engaging our children in learning opportunities that may be outside the science, math, social studies, language arts core. And then we've got wraparound partners that help us in the aftercare area. So we feed kids breakfast and lunch. So for parents that are looking to reengage in the work world as that slowly begins to return to normal, there's the opportunity for full-time, in loco parentis as we serve in place of parents during the school day. And I think there's a huge reassurance for that, from parents. And so I think that that's really spurred this enhanced enrollment for us. We're planning on using the ESSER dollars that are available to us over the course of the next four summers to maintain this really robust summer school program. And we're hoping that that's going to give us the longitudinal data to show how effectively that works for our kids and then look at that as a long-term solution for the community of Green Bay.
And looking even more ahead, the district is opening an online school this fall. Tell us about that effort.
So we know that some kids learn more effectively online for lots of different reasons, some academic, some social, emotional. And we have parents that would like to continue that opportunity for their kids. We've always had that grade 6 to 12 here in the district. We had not had that in a pre-K to 5 environment. I think going back to your very first question, I think we had some preconceptions about how difficult it might be to teach a kindergartner online versus a senior in high school. We certainly discovered that with the amazing staff that we have that you can teach kindergarten online. And so we're going to open a pre-K to 5 online elementary school this fall. And that'll afford those parents who wish to have their children main learning at home the opportunity to do so. We are actually housing it in one of our schools so that there'll be a physical connection with students and staff. So if there's a need for them to come into school to visit with a teacher, to meet with a counselor, to talk to the principal, there'll certainly be the opportunity to do that. They'll create some on-site opportunities for the students to connect outside the school day for special events. It's our teachers teaching our curriculum, so you really are a part of the Green Bay Area Public School District. You're just choosing to receive your instruction online.
We saw parents unhappy with whatever school district they were in with those decisions, open enrolling their kids across districts. So are you hoping to attract students who would normally attend nearby districts with this online opportunity?
Our goal was really to meet the needs of the kids here in the Green Bay Area Public School District because we had heard from parents over the course of the school year that were asking us whether or not we planned to do something for elementary kids in the fall. To be honest with you, we had not been thinking about it until the parents started pushing. And when they did, we started keeping track of how many requests we were getting and realizing that there was a viable need here just within the district. With our 20,000 students to meet that need. And so the intent really was to meet the needs of our students. Open enrollment, I think, serves a purpose for all districts. And certainly if that program meets somebody's needs and they'd like to enroll, there's the opportunity to do so. But it was really designed initially for our kids and our parents.
So you'll welcome the kids and certainly the funding that goes with it. You wouldn't turn students away.
I'll share a little bit of a mythbuster here for you. Open enrollment actually benefits the sending district more than the receiving district from a financial standpoint. So we certainly would welcome anyone who wants to attend. But I think that's one of those, urban legends that's out there that there's just a lack of understanding about how open enrollment works.
Certainly. Steve, thank you so much for explaining what the year has been like and what you're looking forward to. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a great end of the school year. We've got one more graduation tonight, so it's our bookend on a bit of an odd year, but certainly still a really productive one.
You made it. Steve Murley is superintendent of the Green Bay Area Public School District. We talked about this year. Just ahead, a book author shares tips on being productive while working remotely. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.